Thank you for joining us, ladies and gentlemen. We are live Saturdays, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. From Studio M in Los Angeles, I am Stephen Spear, and this is TalkRadio1.com for Saturday, the 27th day of August, 2022. Dr. Buzz Hollander lives on the Big Island of Hawaii, and he has 17 years of experience in both clinical and emergency room settings as a daily practicing physician. He is a specialist in family practice and graduated from Princeton University, attended the UNC Chapel Hill School of Medicine, and completed his residence at California's Santa Rosa Family Medicine Residency Program. Dr. Hollander has written extensively on all things COVID and on many other medical subjects. He authors a Substack in cooperation with Real Clear Politics, which can be found at drbuzz.substack.com. That's doctor spelled out, D-O-C-T-O-R, buzz, B-U-Z-Z, dot, substack.com. Dr. Hollander has been on Talk Radio 1 with me twice before. We've talked about COVID. We've talked about medical care. We've talked about all sorts of things. And I'll give you the dates for those podcasts when we get to the end of this, if you'd like to go back and listen to them. Or you can send me an email. I'll be glad to send you the links. It is my pleasure to say, Dr. Buzz Hollander, welcome back to TalkRadio1.com.
Thanks, Steve. It's nice to be back on with you.
I have thought for a long time that the big three issues in medical care from which all of our problems across the nation arise and from which all solutions will rise boil down to three categories. And I want to run these three by you and see if I'm right, if there are three, if you've got a fourth, or if I'm wrong about these. The three areas are quality of medical care, accessibility to medical care, and cost of medical care. So first, do I have three that are right? Is there a fourth?
I don't think anybody would quibble with those three. From my perspective as a physician and also as someone who occasionally has had to be a consumer of healthcare, in the case of my parents, I would add satisfaction to that. I know that could be rolled into quality, but it's possible to get good quality healthcare and to provide good quality healthcare and still hate the process every step of the way. And I think in the long run, that's not sustainable.
So maybe what we call it is quality, that category, quality, satisfaction, experience, the entire experience of it. I think that's probably we'll put it in there and talk about it. Which one should we start with? Quality, accessibility, or cost? Do you have a feeling on that? Because if not, I do.
I would say that a lot of this comes out of cost, because that's ultimately probably determines what you can and cannot do, is what you can and cannot afford.
So I have a theory that the cost and the quality and the accessibility all derive from what motivates the structure of how medicine, the practice of medicine, the delivery of medical services by medical providers arises, and that right now the entire system is aimed toward who's paying for it, rather than the consumer, the patient who's consuming the medical services. It's directed toward who's paying for it, which could be, in rare occasions, the patient, lots of times insurance companies, and lots of times the government. So cost looks to me like a problem because it creates difficulty with both quality and accessibility. Thoughts?
I agree, and I think that's the biggest single problem with the American system, is this rather absurd setup in which it is this strange mix of private and governmental payers, namely this collection of private insurance companies. And then you've got Medicare and Medicaid for people with less means. And everyone has their own program in terms of how the payment model has been formed. But what is shared is that I think the number sits around 90% of physicians, and it's going to be almost 100% of hospitals, are plugged into this system in which one form of insurance, whether it's Medicare, Medicaid, or private insurance, is what determines reimbursement. And if you think about the three ways that we generally pay for things in this country, it's most of the time, it's whatever you want to call it, a la carte or menu-based payments, but you walk into a store and the prices are listed, you know what you're going to pay. And sometimes it's a membership type of model, like when you go on Netflix and you pay your monthly fee and you can watch however many movies or whatever movies you want to watch. And then you've got this third way of paying for things, which is more like car insurance, where there is a deal made between the actual providers of the service and the people who are going to pay for the service. You don't know what that deal is. Everybody knows it's not the real value of the service and that there's a deep discount that gets provided between the payer and the provider of the service. And I don't think anybody likes it except the insurance company, because that structure allows them to run an enormous business and pay a lot of people's salaries. I think if you asked anybody, which of those three models would you least want to structure an entire massive system around, I think anybody would say, oh, definitely not the last. And yet that's what we've chosen to do.
So every time there is a major government program that is designed to help out with the medical system, it looks to me like it's aimed at accessibility, not quality, accessibility, not cost. So when I look at Medicare from the 1960s and Medicaid, and here in California, Medi-Cal, and when I look at Obamacare, and when I look at the programs that have been suggested in different places by the government, when it's a government-involved program, it hits accessibility, but it not only doesn't help quality and doesn't help cost, it seems to hurt quality and hurt cost. So let's take Obamacare. It's said that I think it's 20 million people now have access to medical care that they didn't have before, and that's a good thing. But it says nothing about what it's done to quality or what it's done to cost. What are your views on that?
It's hard to increase accessibility without having unwanted effects on cost and quality, certainly. And Obamacare obviously had this whole formula and they had justified how it's actually going to save us money over the long term, et cetera, et cetera. But it's really hard to give people a service who did not have the service before and have it not end up costing more money and putting more strain on the system and thereby affecting quality. And I don't think you'll find a lot of physicians to argue that hasn't happened. And clearly cost has gone up, although people can try to spin that in different ways. But it has, having more healthy people being forced to take on insurance that didn't want it before, has put more people on physicians' rolls. And once you're paying for something, all of a sudden you might start using it where you might have before. That's going to have some positive and some negative implications for people's actual health. But it does mean that you've put more strain on physicians. And what has come along with Obamacare in chronologically is this increasing emphasis on shifting away from the fee-for-service model of insurance, medical insurance, in which back in the old days, before I changed my practice model, if I saw a patient and spent half an hour with them and they were of a certain complexity, I can put in all these codes and I might get $90 or $110 or something back for the visit. And that, of course, incentivized me to make sure my schedule was always completely full, because any half hour without a patient is costing me $100 and I needed every penny just to pay my overhead and pay myself a salary. And so now the goal is to switch over towards more of a membership type model. And that's already happened to a large degree here in Hawaii with the private insurers, where you're getting paid a relatively small amount per month for each person that you provide care for. So now all of a sudden the area providers are incentivized to have as many patients as possible, not necessarily to see them, but rather to have them on their rolls. And that's been good for access because it motivates all the physicians who are already full and they could fill their schedules weeks out and therefore make their maximum salaries in the old system. Now, all of a sudden, they've got room to make more money if they just take more people onto their roles. The problem is when you build up your patient base, yes, it appears that you are providing more access and it allows you to make more money. And from the government's perspective or the private insurer's perspective, you can control costs because there's only so many patients out there that you need to pay the $20 per month fee towards. But in reality, it's not getting you more time to see these patients. And so as physicians have built up their patient census, what tends to happen is you have less time per year to spend with each patient. And I think that creates a huge problem in terms of the quality of care that's provided.
All right. So the problem with the first system, the original system, the one under which you practiced for many years and under which my father practiced for many years, it is that you want to do as many procedures and see as many patients as you can because you get clicks, you get credits, you make money for each of the procedures and each of the things that you do. You want to avoid things that you don't get paid for. You want to do more of the things that you do get paid for, and these are incentives. Now, somebody might idealistically say that well, the doctor should just do what's right and spend all the time and what have you, which is a good way to dismiss the fact that doctors are human beings who get married and perhaps have children and perhaps have a house payment and perhaps don't want to work until they die and would like to have the possibility of saving and investing for a future and for a possible retirement. And that those doctors might want to occasionally go for a walk in the park and eat a candy bar instead of working 80 hours a week. So I will dismiss those who say that doctors should simply, the only people who should become doctors are those who are willing to live in poverty to do it. So let's accept that most people in their lives try to make at least enough money to live well on, not just to live, but to live well on. So that was the first model, and that's no good because then the doctor is incentivized to spend as little time with each patient as possible. Now, your practice and that of many other physicians is based on this, as it's called, a capitation rate, where per capita, per person, you get a dollar amount each month, whether you see the patient or not. So a doctor can have 100 patients or 1,000 patients or 5,000 patients, and it could work with 5,000 patients if all of them were healthy and none of them came in. But it might not even work with 100 patients if all of them were sick and all of them needed care all of the time. And so the difficulty is there's, again, a push-pull where a doctor would like to have as many patients as possible paying X number of dollars per month. But that can only be done if the patient population is sufficiently healthy in that physician's practice so the doctor isn't overwhelmed by 5,000 phone calls at once. Do I have that right so far?
Yeah, and I think one of the best descriptions of what you were referencing in terms of the dangers of incentivizing physicians to do as much as possible was written, I mean, it might have been 10 years ago already, but Atul Gawande wrote a long-form piece, and he looked at the place in America with the most expensive healthcare per capita, and it was some border town in Texas. And the health outcomes were not good. Surprisingly, the per capita income was not high. And it was a place with high rates of poverty. And what he essentially discovered, and I do think this applies to a lot of places in the country, is that it was the culture of testing and treating, often unnecessarily, had gotten so out of hand in this city that the costs had exploded and nobody was benefiting from it, but everybody was getting a CAT scan every time they bonked their head. Everybody was getting an MRI if their shoulder was sore. The people that ordered the tests also owned shares in the companies that were performing the tests. And it was a sort of capitalist model gone berserko, where quality was being sacrificed and costs were exploding because that's what people are getting paid to do. Not a system that works well. And I think that's part of what drives this transition to, we need to control the costs with a capitated model. And obviously I support elements of it because that's what I've essentially chosen in my wife and my practice. And that's to have people pay us a monthly fee and they see us as much as they need to see us. And it gives us a sense of control over our income and predictability and incentivizes us to do really good care so that our patients stay in our practice and choose to stay in our practice. And the volume of care and what we do has got no influence in terms of our income. And the catch is when you try to do that on a large scale, as we're trying to do with CMS right now, trying to get this through with Medicare and Medicaid and many private insurers, I think everybody is probably expecting this to be the way of the future, is how do you get doctors who are now being incentivized to take on as many patients as possible to maximize their income, how do you get them to still do good medicine and not be every bit as overextended as we were before? And the system that they're choosing is this pay for performance or pay for quality, where they, meaning the payer, whether it's government or private insurance, they essentially grade every physician's performance. And the problem is, how do you grade a physician's performance? And what they do is they take all these numbers. How what's the blood pressure on your hypertensive patients? What's the average 3-month A1C blood sugar on your diabetic patients? How well do your patients rate you as a physician? And they take all these things. It takes a big bureaucratic effort on the part of a physician's office to get them all these numbers. So there's an additional expense that just got put back on physicians. And then they literally, our local insurance company, before I ducked out of it, I felt like I was back in grade school. We would be given these score sheets, these 2 or 3 page score sheets with little red traffic lights or yellow lights or green lights in terms of how are we doing? Are we below average, average, above average? And of course, they've rigged the game so that they never have to pay people more because everybody's doing an exceptional job. They just say, oh, well, if everybody got their diabetic patients under better control because now they're financially motivated, well, what was good before is not good enough anymore. And you're now dropped back to average and only the outliers are exceptional and get paid a little bonus per their monthly fee. And it's a game that I think is going to drive physicians crazy because you're constantly having to pay somebody and to mind these numbers instead of really getting into what I would argue is the essence of the doctor-patient relationship, which is an actual relationship that is based on understanding each other and curiosity about what's really happening in a patient's life rather than, uh-oh, your blood pressure is 142 over 90. I got to get it to 138 over 88. So let's adjust your meds so I can get paid a little more.
Sounds like Yelp for doctors.
There's some of that, yes.
So then if that's not how to, I think what they're trying to do is incentivize these things, yes, to keep costs down, yes, but also to assist patients in figuring out which doctors are best. This doesn't sound like a better way to do that. This sounds like a way to get statistics that get gamed, sort of like when people campaign to get an Oscar nomination when they make a movie.
Exactly. I think that the government has to allow that, especially with the way people are using technology now, there's going to be ways for patients to assess the quality of a doctor's work. It's always going to be imperfect, but it's very hard to try to do it on a statistical basis. If I've got patients who are motivated, I can get my diabetic patients' A1C levels down low. It doesn't make me a better doctor than somebody who's got a really challenging panel of people without good access to care or healthy foods. If their diabetic patients have bad numbers, it doesn't mean they're a bad doctor. Really hard to get these things to equate well.
So if I were to ask you, how many patients do you have in your practice and what is the maximum number of patients a doctor should have in a capitated practice, a per patient fee for unlimited service, it would be an impossible question to answer, wouldn't it? Because it depends on whether your medical practice is made up of a bunch of 20 and 30 and 40-year-olds or whether your medical practice is made up of a bunch of 70 and 80 and 90-year-olds.
Yeah, and not to mention the social complexity of your patients really plays a bigger role, I would say, than age. And that's why, I mean, we've
said
what
do you mean
practice,
by social complexity? Tell me about that.
Well, when I worked at the community health center that was down the road for the first 7 years of my practice here in Hawaii, that was a take-all comers, is federally qualified community health center, meaning that they got federal aid in caring for people who did not have means and did not even have insurance. And it was a broad mix of people, but we certainly had a high percentage of patients who were struggling in terms of finances. And that creates a completely different set of challenges as a physician when you've got patients who are homeless, when you have patients who, immigrants from the Marshall Islands, who are packing 10 family members into a room. It's very hard to get someone to control their diabetes if they can't even keep their insulin chilled. It's hard if there's language barriers, if they're working three jobs and therefore have no time to even remember to take their medications. It is a completely different style of practicing medicine than what I'm doing now, where we try to keep our practice around 350 patients at most. And everybody in my practice cares enough and has the means to devote roughly $150 a month to having me be their doctor and my wife. And that sets a very different bar in terms of my ability to come up with a plan and my patient's ability to follow it if they're motivated. And if when I'm caring for people with more chaotic social networks, the amount of time required and energy to try to get the most basic healthcare becomes a much greater challenge. So for me, I can fill my days with a small panel, like 350 patients, trying to provide a really high level of care and attention to my patients. I think an average physician who doesn't need or even want to spend 45 minutes per visit with a patient like I do, then they would happily function very well, I think, with 800, 1,000, maybe even 1,200 patients. I think most physicians would be thrilled and really feel like they could invest time with their patients. They could probably do 25, 30 minute follow-up visits with patients, and that would feel like a luxury compared to the 10 or 15 minutes that they have now. I think the current model where it's 2,300, 2,500 plus patients per physician, that allows so little time that even if you've got a healthy young population that don't have a lot of societal distractions, I think you're still really going to struggle for the quality element of care because you are always in such a rush to finish with a patient.
So it sounds like the commonly held belief that poor people get less effective medical care and probably less medical care overall than people who can afford more and who can afford vitamins and who can afford fresh vegetables and fresh fruit and so forth. It sounds like that notion applies here too, because the people who are paying $150 a month, $1,800 a year, have to be able to afford to do that, and probably also to make it effective need to be able to afford other things like exercise, time to exercise, proper diet, and so forth. And so then what we come up with is if we're going to help people who don't have those means, that there needs to be, if you're going to help them, if the government is going to help them, the society is going to help them, to subsidize their costs somehow. Is that a solution?
I think it's the only way that you're going to see everybody get medical care. And obviously, your libertarian listeners are going to blanch at that and say, look, if society really can't stand to see people with unreduced fractures lying around on sidewalks because they couldn't get into an ER because they're homeless and don't have insurance, and pensioners unable to see their doctor for their diabetes care and their heart failure care because they can't come up with, you know, $1,000 a month that health insurance costs, then, you know, libertarian would say, well, the private foundation is going to step in and fill the need. I don't know that that's ever happened in the history of the world. So most of us count on the government to do this. And it is so expensive in this society that certainly for a person with genuine health needs, now a healthy 40-year-old could probably get by with a true insurance model, meaning they don't need to see a physician on a regular basis. I might argue it could do them some good, but they don't need to unless they genuinely have an emergency. They break an arm, they have an unexpected heart attack, they get a melanoma on their skin. And people like that, it would be very inexpensive to insure with a true insurance policy, just like your car insurance is for when somebody sideswipes you and the door gets busted in, you can't open it. If we really looked at health insurance with that same model, that would be inexpensive for healthy people. And, you know, you could probably do something like that and they could have great access to really good emergency care. You could probably do a system like that and just charge $300 or $400 a month and maybe even less. The problem is that people with known issues that require regular monthly or quarterly care, that require multiple medications to manage their health problems, those people are expensive. And to quote unquote insure them, which is really just to pay for their regular encounters with the medical system, they probably cost a couple $1,000s a month that you're really putting in the system. So the way our, I would argue, absurd system works is we pretend it's health insurance and we put the payments on the backs of these healthy 40-year-olds who get health insurance through their jobs or on the private market, and everybody's paying $1,000 a month for the most part. And most of that money is going into the unhealthy people who already have needs, and you have to figure out a way to subsidize it, or these people are not going to get health care, and on a societal level, it's not going to look pretty.
All right, so what I'd rather do is take, you described one libertarian answer that I don't like, but I've got another libertarian answer that actually might work. And that is that we have physicians like you who are charging individual patients, as you do, and for the people who can afford to do that, they afford to do that. For the people who cannot, the government pays it. It's money. It is less of a bureaucracy because, for example, Medicare and Obamacare and Medicaid and in California, Medi-Cal are bureaucratic-laden, heavily papered, thoroughly documented and always defrauded, not always, very frequently defrauded systems where there's enormous cost, enormous overhead and overhang of operational costs because they are systems that are supposed to somehow vet these things. If instead you vet the people who need financial help, and you get rid of all of the bureaucratic systems that pass out everything from medical care to food stamps to food subsidies to all different sorts of things, and instead you give them money, and then they hire you. And then the only test becomes means testing. The only test becomes, do you need financial help? And then everybody gets the same medical care. Everybody gets the same medical care. Because they're all paying physicians like you to do the fine work that you do, and those who need assistance from society get it from the government. And it's money instead of food stamps and other things that get billed back and get laden with huge costs, transactions costs, that drive up the cost for everything and falsely misdistribute and redistribute money to bureaucrats.
I'm a big fan of that sort of approach. I spend a lot of time spitballing ideas for what would I do if I were in charge of the system? And honestly, I don't know what I would do because every possible solution has got some major flaws with it. But I think some sort of coexistence of a subsidized national system with a privatized system, I think that's what would need to happen for there to be a generally best outcomes. Now, should it really be as simple as a basically a voucher sort of system? Like you might run into some problems there with most physicians, I think. Let's say you say, okay, our system for primary care. Now, we're going to have to talk about what to do with hospitals and procedures and imaging because that's a whole other beast. But if we just look at primary care for starters, and that's a fair bit of the overall expenses of the healthcare system, I think if you name a price and say, we can afford $35 per month per average patient to give that to doctors. And so that's your voucher and you can give it to a doctor. You run into some problems, namely, if a 73-year-old diabetic on 12 medications who's in and out of the hospital five times a year comes to me with that $35, I'm going to think pretty hard about saying, no, thank you, I'm closed to you. While when a 35-year-old who's in good health comes to me with that $35, I say, you know, you're signed up, and we'll see you tomorrow. And we'll see you once a year and take your money. So finding a way that doesn't get back into these layers and layers of bureaucratic algorithms to appropriately compensate physicians is tricky. There's got to be ways that you can do it. And I think if physicians have to carry a large enough panel and can't give thumbs up and thumbs down to patients based on how complex they are, then you can get that to work. And it might just be that you could keep it more of a two-tier system where there's the government rate and you have to decide, are you in or are you out? And physicians who think that they can, like me, charge a large amount relative to that $35 and maintain a small patient census because that's the way I like to practice, well, we can stick our necks out and see if we can build up enough patients to be able to make a living. And physicians who are new, just out of training, physicians who have never been particularly popular, maybe because they've got a cranky bedside manner. These are people who might decide, I'm in the model. I'll accept payment from the government and I won't charge my patients more than that. You might need to put restrictions like that so that there's truly access, because one of the things you're going to have to deal with is that we already have a shortage of physicians. In other words, if we think each physician should only have 1,000 patients, there's not enough primary care physicians. And it's going to take many years of shifting the way that we train physicians to have enough. Now, I might argue that we can look at certain specialties like anesthesia and dermatology and radiology and pathology that we don't need as many of these people as we have. Apologies to any listeners who are in those four fields, but these are fields that are going to go by the wayside as AI really gets a footprint in medicine. We're just not going to need very many of them. And so to start announcing that these residencies, we're going to start paying for you to have fewer and fewer residents and start being willing to pay more for primary care physicians, you can start to shift some people out of the less necessary fields into where we really need people, which is pediatrics and OBGYN, internal medicine and family medicine. I think you could achieve that over time, but you know, we're talking easily a 10-year project where all these plans go up in smoke when every doctor is only taking 500 or 800 patients because their lives are better. And now all of a sudden nobody can get a doctor anymore.
So I have an idea which I think would be absolutely ideal and would solve all of these problems, the quality, the access, and the cost. And I'm going to offer that to you right now. And I'll tell you, the only reason it won't work is politics. But if we can get past the politics, I believe my idea will work. And we'll see what you think. But first, I want to direct everyone's attention to the Substack written by my guest, Dr. Buzz Hollander. You would find it by going to drbuzz.substack.com. Doctor is spelled out, D-O-C-T-O-R, Buzz, B-U-Z-Z, dot, Substack, www.thebestofbusinessbook.com. And just so you'll have a sense as to what you might find there, I'm going to read the titles of a few of these articles to you. President Biden's Paxlovid and the Problem with Overtreatment. The new polio outbreak is bad, but why hasn't it become a disaster yet? Was Tom Cruise right about antidepressants? Putting long COVID in perspective, does urolithin A work as a muscle-building supplement? The safe and effective Moderna COVID vaccine for infants might be neither. And how about this one? Is your nightlight making you fat? Which is a reference to a new study that links nighttime light exposure to poor metabolic health. These are some of the articles you can find at Buzz Hollander's Substack. I recommend it. It's good reading. It's interesting stuff, and you'll learn a lot. So, Dr. Hollander, my idea is this. This would be a single payer, and it would be the government, and it would cost less, I believe, than Medicare and Medicaid. And on the state levels, Medi-Cal in California, the various state programs, I think it would cost less. And here's what it would be. Every man, woman, and child would receive a card. Same thing as we get like a gift card, you know, from the store. And that card would be charged with X number of dollars. I'm going to say $4,000 a year. $4,000 a year for medical care. And each person, every man, woman, and child would be able to take that card, and it could be on your iPhone, it could be any the modality is unimportant, but it would be something that would be identified as you, and you can take that to any healthcare provider. And then healthcare providers would have to compete through price transparency, the very same way as right now. There's a dollar value meal at Jack in the Box, and there's one at Taco Bell, and there's one at McDonald's, and there's one at Burger King, and there's one at Wendy's. And all of these places compete on the basis of price and everything else they have to offer: quality, taste, speed, convenience, safety. And medical providers would need to compete on that basis. And there would be requirements for you to be able to use as a medical provider, for you to be able to provide. So you need the appropriate license, whether it's a physician or a physician's assistant or a nurse practitioner, or I don't know, add chiropractors in, add in dentists, add in whatever it would be. And this $4,000 a year would be what you would have to spend. And if it ran out, the government would pay for everything over that. There's no limit. You'd get all the care you need. But if you spend less than the $4,000 a year, you can cash it in. Not immediately, but 5 years later. So let's say you have a $4,000 credit on your card and you only spend $1,500 on medical care this year. 5 years after the end of that year, you'd get the difference. You'd get $2,500 from the government as a rebate. And so what you'd have is a competitive market like you do in practically everything else. If I'm a practicing real estate and business attorney and I have my hourly rate, but if my hourly rate is three times as much as another lawyer's hourly rate, I'm probably going to have fewer clients. And if McDonald's begins selling a quarter pounder with cheese for $18, they're probably going to lose a lot of business to Jack in the Box and Burger King. And so you turn medical service into what it used to be and what it should be, which is price transparency and competition based on many things, including price, but quality and so forth. So you'd get to a place where people would recommend their physician, and they would recommend the physician because the physician was better than the next physician, and that physician could probably charge more. And then other physicians who need to attract patients might lower their prices to do that, and everybody's taken care of. this won't happen because the insurance lobby would be against it, because there'd be no reason for an insurance company to sell medical insurance ever again. The government would be against it because they wouldn't be in control of handing out things. So the politics of approving government spending in order to get votes, which is something practiced by both Democrats and Republicans in different ways at different times, would be gone because there'd be nothing political to gain from it. And so politically, this won't happen. But if it could, Dr. Buzz Hollander, what do you think?
Well, I think, first of all, if we're going to kick around ideas about reforming the U.S. healthcare system, we have to just take as an assumption that we are blowing up the insurance industry, that things are so bad that everybody agrees their lobby doesn't exist anymore, and they're ignored. They suck too much money out of the system and make it too absurd. So I think it's okay to drop that as an issue, because after all, there are many countries in the Western world who have gotten rid of insurance, health insurance, that is, and going with single payer type systems, which are the government as a single payer, of course. So I think we can kick that around. The political stuff, yeah. But look, some things are changing, and I think people are more and more receptive to this notion that having the government micromanage every expenditure doesn't work out that well. So let's pretend. I think it's hard enough coming up with a good plan, whether or not it's politically or practically feasible. So my main concern with what you just proposed, and I like a lot of the aspects of it, especially you need to find a way to incentivize patients to only get the amount of care that they need, not less. In other words, you don't want the diabetic staying home and seeing the doctor every other year because they want to get an extra $50 in their pocket because they need the care. So you don't want people getting less care than they need, but you obviously want to keep people from getting more than they need. If they've got a sore shoulder for 2 weeks, they don't need an MRI. So discouraging them from overindulging in medical care is a huge win, really, for everybody, including the patient. So I think 4,000 is probably too low, unfortunately, if there's really going to be price competition among physicians. But my biggest concern is
change
what you
it.
Said
no,
about
no,
once you
it.
Go.
Change it. What will you do instead of 4,000 in today's dollars? Because I'm modifying this program. My 5-year delay, all these things have come up over the years as I've told this to more people who've told me there's a problem and I adjust it. So instead of 4,000, how much?
Well, we're going to have to get into the what expenses we're going to cover aspect, which we're overdue to dig into the big amount of medical expenses, which do not run through your primary care physician's office. And we'll get there in a second. But I also, when you say anything over that, say $4,000 cutoff is covered by the government, how does that work?
So the idea would be that, let's say someone has a horrible problem, they have cancer, and they need constant care, and it's going to just cost a tremendous amount of money. I don't want those people to be without coverage, because then I run into all the problems that you have when you have people who can't get medical care. So for the seriously ill who will never get the rebate, but they'll get the medical care, I want them to be covered. I don't want stop losses. I don't want policy limits. I don't want the insurance to say, well, okay, now we've spent our $1 million in care on you. Now you're on your own. And now you can sell your house.
Well, I'm sure you have grappled with this, but it really creates a moral hazard with, it's going to be very easy to get to a $4,000 bar, or probably even a $6,000 or an $8,000 bar. And then you create this moral hazard of, okay, I'm not getting a rebate, so I'm going to get that MRI on my shoulder, because who cares? How do you discourage
you have
people
to set
once
it high
they
enough.
Hit their limit?
You have to set it high enough. Maybe it's $10,000 a year. Maybe it's 12. And maybe instead of waiting 5 years, maybe you get half the money if you save it in 5 years and the other half in 10. And by the way, you have to be alive to get it.
Right. That's an incentive. Well, let's talk about all those other costs. Because I think that Medicare, for instance, almost half, I think it's around 40% of their expenditures go to hospitals. And a substantial amount goes to labs, imaging centers for MRIs and CAT scans. There's a specialist cost when you go see a cardiologist or an endocrinologist, that there's a big proportion of our annual health expenses as a nation are not being run through your primary care office. And that's where the big money payments tend to be. So how do you get a grip on those costs? And I would say that the first step is you have to pull out of this insurance model where it's literally negotiated on a hospital-to-hospital basis and a specialist-to-specialist basis where, you know, a cardiologist hangs their shingle and they're having to call up. In some states, it's probably 5 or 10 different health insurance providers and say, all right, what am I going to get for a half-hour visit? What am I going to get for a 45-minute visit? What am I going to get when I do a stent? You know, and it's a really crazy system. And nobody knows that amount except the insurance company and the cardiologist. And, you know, for instance, when I was starting out in private practice after I left the community health center, I, like everybody, I had to work with a billing company because I didn't want to hire somebody for a small practice to be just doing billing. So the billing company that I hired, they suggested to me, well, first of all, we had to go to all the different insurance companies and find out how much they're going to pay me for every single thing that I could do as a primary care doctor. And what my firm suggested I do is they said, well, whatever price they give you, whatever price Medicare gives you, because that's sort of our benchmark, just multiply it by 10 and charge that. And I was like, why on earth would I do that? They said, oh, well, in case you get a private insurance that allows a higher payment, they won't ever pay more than the benchmark you've set. So always just pick a crazy high benchmark just in case someone will pay it.
Yeah, like and the rack rate in a hotel.
Exactly. And it creates this sort of, you know, a hotel likes the idea that people look at the door and say, oh, I'm staying in a real luxury hotel and I'm only paying $180 a night. But the reality is people know it's absurd. And in medicine, it's not such a good look. Because if they're getting a bill from me and it says Dr. Hollinger charged $1,000 for the visit, however, we're only paying $95, it makes me look like a greedy son of a gun. So this is the sort of game that's being played. It's incredibly inefficient. And I would argue that, look, we've got a price set somewhere for every single thing that a hospital does or an imaging center or a lab does, down to the cost of a Tylenol and the nurse administering the Tylenol. There is literally a dollar and cent amount for every single thing. So it's not a lot to ask these companies to say, to hammer out an arrangement. It would probably need to be done with the government via Medicare type CMS service to say, look, this is what it really costs us to dispense a Tylenol. This is what it really costs us to do a chest x-ray. And once you establish that price, that is the price that you list on your website, at your window when you go in for a chest x-ray, and the people paying cash pay that amount, and therefore the price that they set is going to be in price competition. Now, there's not a lot of it in a rural island like the Big Island of Hawaii, but in LA or New York or Philadelphia, there's going to be multiple imaging centers within an hour's drive. And so the people using this voucher or having to pay cash are going to make their choices based on the price that you've got listed on your website or on your front door. And if that's also the price that you would charge the government, then I think that that is going to save so much in terms of bureaucratic costs, because a lot of people, you have to pay a lot of people to quibble about these prices. But once you really set that and make it transparent, all of a sudden you've got a way for price competition to take place that has hardly been happening up to this point. And it really makes people say, okay, I'm going to drop $500,000 on an MRI machine, and I think I'm going to get X number of MRIs out of it before I have to replace it in 10 or 15 years. Therefore, I need to charge this price, and it's going to drive prices down to the marginal cost of what it really, true expense for these companies. And I think that is it maybe the only easy way to save money in this whole system, because everything else comes with so many other possible hidden costs. Now, the question is, how do we integrate this into your voucher? Because an MRI is, you know, in the insurance model, it's usually about $2,000. When you get in heavily contested areas where there's a lot of freestanding imaging centers that are trying to get cash pay customers, it can get all the way down to $500 or even less. So I think you can start to see costs get down to that level with price competition. But wow, you know, if an MRI is going to be $500 and shoulder surgery, I don't know that you can really get it down under a couple grand to pay for an anesthesiologist and an orthopedic surgeon who specializes in shoulders, and the hospital's got to rent the space to you and all this stuff. When things go wrong, not to mention you get hit by a car and have a head injury and have to be in the ICU for 10 days, which currently you're looking at $100,000+. Now, I think that's ridiculous. It should, you know, unless you're staying at the finest Hilton, nothing should ever cost that much per night. But how to integrate these, and maybe the way to do it is once you find that optimal cutoff for the Steve voucher system, that and the government really is picking up everything else, or maybe it should be 90% of everything else if you don't pass the means testing and can afford a little more. So you've got some discouragement for just getting the best one possible. That maybe you save a lot of money by dropping the price that the government is paying that MRI center from $2,000 to $400. It could make a massive difference.
I think it could. And it seems to me like a common thread through what I've said and what you said is that we would need to get the insurance companies completely out. And we'd need to get the government bureaucracy out completely, so that instead of decisions being made by bean counters, they're made by physicians and business people who are competing on the proper basis for business, just like McDonald's does. And just like a steakhouse, a fine steakhouse that charges $70 for a New York strip steak is competing with all of the other steakhouses, and they have to really hit quality. So because people will be very concerned about quality with their medical care, that's the sort of thing where, if you will, the medical Yelp, the word of mouth system, the reviews that doctors get are going to make a great deal of difference, like they do in so many things today.
And I do appreciate that this allows for centers that do better work, physicians who have better bedside manner and clinical acumen, hospitals that provide better patient experiences, that it does allow them to outcompete. Because in the current system, one of the weird things about being a doctor is you'd think that you improve your skills over the years. Now, some people argue against that, and I think most people would admit that there's a sort of sweet spot, maybe 5 or 10 years out of training, where you're both maximizing recent training with some degree of experience in dealing with real problems. But it does seem like a really skilled doctor ought to be able to earn more than they did when they didn't have those skills. And yet the way the system works, especially if you're a private physician with your own practice,
yeah,
you don't make more money the longer you practice. You can get better and better and better, and yet you're still stuck making the same amount you did when you were 1 week out of residency. And I think that the American way is that if you're better at something, people will figure it out and they'll bid for your services. And I think it's appropriate, rather than every doctor making the same income everywhere in the country, whether they're terrible at their job and have checked out years ago, or whether they're really skillful.
As always happens when you and I speak, Dr. Buzz Hollander, we run out of time, and we're not quite out of time, but there are a couple of things I want to hit if we can. You have a story that you told. A patient of yours was dying in the intensive care unit and really wanted to go home to die. Tell that story.
Yeah, thank you for asking, Steve. This had happened just in the days before our last conversation, and really left an impression on me. And I hadn't had a chance to check in with the widow of the patient and make sure it's okay with her for me to discuss this. But I did speak to her, and she's happy for me to share. And to me, it really encapsulates both why I want to be a doctor in the first place and why I'm so glad that I changed systems to one that gave me the flexibility to both really get to know my patients and to be really available to them when things go wrong. Because I think most patients would agree that it's nice to have a competent doctor to look at your cholesterol panel and assess your blood sugar and all those things. But when it really comes down to it, if that doctor is not available to you when you are really in a time of need, it's not worth a whole lot. And so this particular situation was with a patient that had moved to the island maybe 5-6 years ago and just had gotten to know he and his wife well. He had some medical complications. He was somebody I saw more often rather than less often. And we had a nice rapport. I'd bump into him at the farmer's market with his wife. It was a really nice small town sort of doctor-patient relationship. And what happened with him is unexpectedly his health went south in a hurry. And some sort of pneumonia appeared. His breathing got really bad. We sent him to the hospital. He didn't really want to go. He's, let's say, around 80. He had a good life. His health was a little bit tenuous, and he's not somebody who wanted to live forever. But, he's calling me from his house. I can hear he's working harder to breathe than normal, and he sounds uncomfortable. And I'm telling him, look, you've got to go to the hospital to work this up. I think that they can heal you. I think you'll be back home in a week or two, and you'll be back at your baseline. He really didn't want to go. He needed me to talk him into it. But he went with a lot of pushing and shoving from his wife as well, because she was very worried. So he goes to the ER. They admit him for a couple of days. I talk to the hospitalist, and basically nobody can figure out why he's got this pneumonia that's not responding to antibiotics, testing negative for everything. So he stabilizes, gets sent home again. And the problem is he's not getting better. So we talk on the phone again, and he really seems to be going downhill. And again, I'm grateful for the fact that I can have an hour in the middle of the day where I can consult a pulmonologist, where I can call his hospitalist, I can talk to his wife, and we can really try to figure out what's going on. But at the end of the day, nobody could figure out what was going on and why he kept getting worse and worse. So another phone call one evening after work, and he's really seems to be going downhill. And, again, he doesn't want to go in. It's like, it's my time. It's my time. I'm going to die. It's okay. I want to die at home. But I still feel like, even though I'm not the pushiest doctor about making people get medical care when they don't want it, I still feel like there's still a good chance of a good outcome. So long talk, he's struggling to speak, and we agree barely that he's going to go back in. So I feel a certain responsibility that he's back in the belly of the beast in the hospital where he never wanted to be in the first place. And unfortunately, it's obvious that he was right. He really is dying, and it doesn't appear that there's anything we can do for him. So I go to work one morning, and I've got a couple people on the schedule in the morning, and I get a call from his wife. We're in the ICU, and the doctor thinks that he's not going to make it. And she did say it's okay for me to use his name. So I'm able to call up my patients. I move my morning patients to the afternoon. They're totally understanding. And I go into the hospital, and he is basically not responding anymore. He's not talking. He's not opening his eyes. But the last time that he spoke to his wife, he had told her, like, get Dr. Buzz in here. I gotta talk to Dr. Buzz about this. So that she had basically begged me, can you please come in? I know you're busy right now. I know you're in clinic, but can you please come in? He needs to see you. And I show up, and you look at his numbers. He looks like a man who's dying. I talk to the hospitalist who's caring for him in the ICU. He agrees, it's just a matter of time. And when I go there and I take his hand and I say, hey, it's me, it's Buzz, I'm here. And I'm going to tear up talking about this, but he opens his eyes, and all of a sudden the light is back on for the first time that morning. And he talks to me a little bit. It's not a lot, but he asks a couple questions. He needed me to tell him that this is really it. He was right. There's nothing we can do for him. And I could ask him, do you want to just go home? You're going to die if you go home. We can't give you enough oxygen to keep you alive, but it, do you want that? And he's able to clearly look me in the eye and say, yes, you know, this is what I want. And then he dropped back again. And I've seen this kind of thing happen with family members, with people that are dying before. But I think in this case, there was some part of our relationship that had this sacred place for him, that he needed his doctor to tell him it was okay to give up, that this was the right thing to do. And I was so grateful that I could take a morning and devote it to this man's last day and try to make things happen. And we were calling hospice. We're talking to the ambulance agency, trying to figure out, is there a way we can get this man home alive so that he could die in his own home? Turned out we couldn't. We really tried. It worked out okay. He stayed in his hospital bed. His whole family was able to get there before he died. He never really opened his eyes and responded again. But it gave his wife and me this sense that he had gotten to make an informed decision. And he had taken control of his life at the end of his life and gone out in his own way. And it's a story that couldn't have happened for me if I had had a full clinic working for a community health center where I know you can't take your morning off. We can't call 12 patients and tell them to reschedule their appointments. Or even when I had my own business, it would have been so painful because that's my revenue. That's my profit for the day. Down in smoke, and I can't make it up. And so to be in a system where there's the flexibility to drop everything and really care for a man in his dying day, it meant everything to me, and I think it meant a lot to him and his wife to be able to be that person in his moment of need.
It's a beautiful story, and it explains from an angle why you wanted to be a physician to begin with, why you like practicing medicine, and there are a number of other lessons in there as well. What that patient was doing is he had relied on you and taken your word for it when you said that if you go home, we can get you, if you do this and you this, you might recover, you might be able to go back to baseline and live more days. And so he trusted you to do that, and he finally needed permission to allow himself to die, and you were able to give him that permission because you had given him permission to live on other occasions when he thought he should give up, and you knew that he shouldn't, and you were right. And on this last time, listen, none of us are getting out of here alive. Eventually, everyone's going to die. But he got extra time that way, and he got the freedom to die when he wanted. And this is what happens when there can be a real connection between a patient and a physician, or a client and a lawyer, or a parishioner and a priest. If you have, or a congregant and a rabbi, if you have a relationship with the people who are giving you advice, where you are willing to take that advice and allow their judgment to guide you rather than substituting your own judgment for that of the professional from whom you sought advice, life is improved. And so there's that lesson in there too, that each of us, as we speak to our doctors, need to understand that we're seeking advice, not procedures. We're seeking insight from experience and talent and education, not just here, take this pill. It's a critical lesson for everyone to learn. And this is what happened, I think, during COVID a lot, is people got their information from the news and from the fragmented news media or social media or both, instead of what everyone should have done, which is go ask their own physician. I had a conversation with a fellow who didn't want to get vaccinated. And he said, but I'm going to ask my doctor, and I've got these 20 questions I'm going to ask my doctor. And I said, well, You sound dedicated to not taking the vaccine. If you get all of your questions asked and answered, and the doctor says, yeah, given all of the things I know about you as my patient, you should get the vaccine. Will you get the vaccine? And he said, no, I don't think you should take the vaccine. And I said, then why are you bothering to have a doctor? Why don't you just watch, you know, whatever you're watching on your computer and decide there? Why bother asking your doctor? And he could not grasp the concept that what he was doing is substituting news media's and social media's views of the vaccine for his own physician. But he was going to ask his physician anyway, but it didn't matter what the advice would be. Your patient, Dr. Buzz, when you gave that advice, your patient listened to you on the occasions that you said, get better, you can get better, you can return to your life and continue living. And then he wanted to listen to you and get permission to finally say, okay, now I am going to die. It's a beautiful story.
Yeah, and I'm sure that you have encountered the same sorts of situations as a lawyer where it ultimately comes down to if the people you work with regard your counsel highly and trust you, they are going to act upon your counsel. And if you haven't had a chance to form that relationship, or the person is just too skeptical of the advice that you dispense, they need another lawyer, just like
100%
you need another doctor.
Happens all the time. It's too long a story to tell the long version. I'll tell the short version. I had a client who was being sued, and he was so strong, felt strongly had done nothing wrong. He shouldn't lose this lawsuit. But I explained to him that the evidence demonstrated in a way that would persuade a jury that he should lose, even though I agreed with him morally, ethically, he shouldn't lose, but he's going to lose. And I said, you need someone else to sing this song for you at trial. You need a different lawyer, someone who actually thinks they can win this case, because I think it can't be won. And so he agreed, and he fired me, and we were representing him in 10 different transactions and challenges and conflict resolutions. He kept us for all of those, but for this one, he hired a law firm who told him, yes, we will win for you. And he lost twice as much money as I thought he would lose, but he lost. And he didn't have any regret. He said, look, I'm a big boy. I'm a good sport. And I made my bet on this and I lost. So I'll pay the price. But he couldn't take the advice. And that was the last time that happened with him. He then listened in going forward. We would weigh and balance everything, and he'd say, what do you think? And when I told him what I think, he didn't substitute his judgment for mine on that. So, yes, it happens in every profession, and it happens when parents are listening or not listening to their parents, or when children are listening or not listening to their parents, or when friends listen or don't listen to advice that they get from people whom they love and trust. Dr. Buzz Hollander, I want to say thank you so much for being with me today. As always, we run completely out of time, getting to about a third of everything we want to talk to. And so I'd love to have you back on and do this again.
Thanks. And you know, I feel inspired to devote a Substack post to the Steve voucher system. And I'll see if I can sketch out that I really like. And I'll give you credit.
You know what? Do that if you would, and send me an email and tell me, because I'll announce it on the show, and we'll talk about that Substack next time we have you on the show. That's exciting. Thank you. That's a lovely thing.
Best thing to do is bounce ideas through smart people's minds, and sometimes you can hammer out a pretty good notion.
That's fantastic. Thanks for being on. We'll do this again.
Thanks. I enjoyed it, Steve.
Ladies and gentlemen, I want to say thank you to Dr. Buzz Hollander. He was on with us. He's been on with us twice before. I'm going to give you those dates right now. You can find these shows easily by looking for them by date on the TalkRadio1.com website. January 22, 2022. April 30, 2022. That's January the 22nd. and April the 30th. Take a look. Take a listen to those. We talked about COVID. We talked about the medical system. We talked about my dad's career as a physician and what lessons could be learned today from that, and about how Dr. Hollander runs his practice and what he does today that's different. Those are things to listen to. You can find information about Dr. Hollander himself at irisintegrativehealth.com. That's I-R-I-S, integrativehealth.com. And I want to once again talk about the Substack. Fascinating articles, very worth reading. And apparently there's going to want to be one about my idea on there too. Dr. Buzz at Substack.com. That's Dr. spelled out, D-O-C-T-O-R, Buzz, B-U-Z-Z, dot, Substack, dot, com. Dr. Buzz, dot, Substack.com. My next show is going to be a week from today. Before the telephone, ladies and gentlemen, you could only speak to people who were standing within a few dozen feet of you. And now you can talk to anyone, anytime, anywhere in the world. And when I say that, you say, well, sure, because today we take all that for granted. But before the telephone, speaking to someone two houses away from you was unimaginable. My guest is going to be Richard John, who has written a book called Network Nation, Inventing American Telecommunications, the history of how it happened, how we got where we were, what the bumps were along the way. That's 1 week from today, next Saturday, September 3rd, 2022, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. Please use our Amazon, PayPal, and eBay links to support the fine programming here on TalkRadio1.com. My email address, steve@talkradio1.com. steve@talkradioone.com. Thank you so much for listening today, ladies and gentlemen. I am Stephen Spearer. Throughout the country and around the world, this is TalkRadio1.com.